welcome to Aerial Evolution. Today, I have a special guest host, Lydia Lara. Hi, Lydia.
Hi, Rowan. Thank you so much for having me back. I'm super, super excited.
So I have Lydia here with me today because she knows today's guest, Brian Donaldson. He not only is an aerialist, but also a rigger, which is how you know him.
Right, correct. I met Ryan about five, six years ago because I did a rigging course with him at one of the festivals. And then I've seen him through the years doing rigging work. And it wasn't until Jane talked to you about him that I remember that I had heard that he was first an aerialist that transitioned into rigging. So I'm really excited about learning his aerial journey and what kind of work he was doing before he went into the rigging world.
Well, fantastic. So let's go ahead and get Brian on and see what his story is.
So exciting. Oh, and this will be your first guy that you're interviewing.
First guy, first rigger. So let's do it.
Let's do it. We first met at the IADF.
Yep.
And then the last time there was an EADF, we were both there.
Oh, yeah. No, you definitely look familiar. So nice to see you again.
Yes, so welcome. Just so you know, Brian, this is fundamentally an aerial history podcast, and I'm really interested in the origins of it and like how this all came to be and how it's developed over the years. And I reached out to Jane Osborne, and she recommended you from what she calls the old days. And also, you know, since you are a rigger, I'm really interested in that too, in the development of rigging over the years. So
Sure. Yeah, interesting.
And when Rowan asked me if there were guys, we were thinking more performers. And I was like, I don't know. I when Jane sent your name, then I remember that I knew that you had been a performer before. But since I've known you always as a rigger, I didn't know that side of your career. So I'm very excited. Yeah. Tell us all about it. When did you start?
Well, I started in the circus business back in New Zealand. I'm from New Zealand. And my very first circus that I worked with was first started in 1991. I was 18 years old. And I'd never worked as an aerialist before starting work in the circus, funnily enough. I actually started working in the circus as a magician.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I'd always been interested in magic from a very early age, and circus came to town and they were looking for a magician. Hmm. So that's how I got into the circus business. And then I worked with that particular show for a couple of years, but the boss on that show, he'd sent off to an agent in the States, I think it was, looking to bring over some acts for the following season. And the agent had sent over a VHS, that's how long ago it was, VHS tapes, with show reels of various artists, basically, for him to have a look at. And he called me into his caravan one day and said, yeah, have a look at this. And it was a swing act, basically like a solid sort of swing that was made out of stainless steel that used to swing backwards and forwards and would end up going around 360. And he said, do you reckon you could do that? And I said, well, give it a go. And so before I knew it, he'd actually been in touch with an engineer and he got a prop made up and he rigged it up and said, right, go on then, up you get. And so I climbed up and gave it a push and he said, now don't go too crazy. So carried on pushing it, ended up swinging all the way around. He said, oh, that's great. Put that in the show tonight. And so that was my baptism of fire into the world of aerial.
Wow.
And it started from there. And then I went over to the UK in 1993. So I toured for a couple of years with the circus in New Zealand by that stage and went over to the UK just to see what was going on the other side of the world. And ended up working with there's a couple of brothers that had a Wheel of Death act, the Campbell brothers. And one of the brothers had fallen off and injured himself. And so they'd had a contract and they're looking for a partner for a replacement. So again, I volunteered and threw myself into the deep end and ended up working as an aerial of death performer for that particular season.
Tell me more about what is it? So we're not exactly, is it the one with you going there and you're riding a bike or is it?
No, you're thinking of the Wall of Death.
Okay.
So, they also have the Globe of Death, which they use motorbikes as well. But the Wheel of Death is basically, if you imagine two sort of like big hamster cages, big enough to take people.
Oh, yeah.
And it's joined in the middle by a big axle and the whole thing rotates around sort of 360. and then the artists perform on the inside and the outside of the wheel as it's going around. So yeah, that was fun.
Crazy. So you had no previous training, and you're like, okay, I can do it. I'll give it a go. And
well, yeah, I mean, yeah, sort of back then it was a bit different, you know. Obviously things have changed a lot since then, but back then sort of you literally could just run away with the circus, and if you're lucky, you learnt as you went on the road. Obviously things have changed a lot these days. You need pretty much a degree in circus, or you have to have come from, you know, a gymnastic or a sports acrobatic background to really have a look in these days with most competitive style shows. But, you know, back then it was certainly a little bit more flexible for people like me to be able to get into the business.
Right.
Yeah, it sounds like you just needed to have the attitude of, okay, let's give it a shot.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was always sort of like physically inclined as a kid. You know, I loved climbing trees. But I mean, you know, all kids do, don't they? I've done a couple of years of gymnastics as a youngster, but not to any sort of level as such. But yeah, sort of just being physically inclined, and I had obviously no fear of heights, and loved the idea of a bit of an adventure. So it was a good combination.
Interesting. Yeah, Jane had mentioned you did a rope act and a cradle act as well.
Yeah, that was in later years. I was actually touring up, well, not touring up, I'd gone up to the Blackpool Tower Circus for a Christmas season performing on the wheel, and I met a Scottish trapeze artist while I was up there, and we ended up becoming a couple and also a working partnership. And she pretty much introduced me to the world of safety in rigging. She was a swinging trapeze artist and used a safety line at the time, doing the sort of the bigger, more gymnastic style release and catch moves, as opposed to the traditional sort of swing and trapeze that you would get once upon a time, where they wouldn't wear a safety either. But we ended up developing a doubles cordelis act, and we toured that for about 7 years around Europe.
Wow.
Various circuses. So it was a really, really good sort of introduction to Europe for me, going into countries like France and Spain and Italy, which obviously, you know, sort of back then as a young kid from New Zealand was a million miles away.
Right.
And I never really entertained the idea of realistically working in circuses in Europe, but did for a good few years. So yeah, cordelis, doubles cordelis was one of the acts that we did. We also developed a casting cradle act, trained up a small flying act as well, which I worked on, a petit volant act, which we toured with a show in France for a year. Yeah, so various aerial disciplines, but they've all been good fun. I have to say though, the cradle is probably the hardest mentally, physically, out of all the acts that we performed. It's quite a demanding act, but certainly the most rewarding as well.
Is that the one where you're basically tossing her around you? And
yeah, that's one way of putting it, I guess. Yeah, the cradle that we performed on was a casting cradle. It's a steel rectangular frame,
mm-hmm.
And usually the catcher would sit in it, and then they swing from their hocks. They have their feet underneath the tow bar, so you have basically two bits of steel that are holding you locked in position, and then the flyer swings beneath you, and then at the back of the swing normally is where they'll do the tricks, pirouettes, somersaults and what have you. Very physical act.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's really rewarding once you get it up to a certain level, you know, after having spent a long time training and then taking it out and working it. Very, very satisfying. It's a very difficult act, and that's why there's not many people that do it. There's a lot of catchers that get injuries from that as well.
Yeah.
I've been one of them. I ended up having quite a bad, well, I say bad, in the early days when we were training it, I had a bit of an incident that ended up stretching two of the cruciate ligaments in one of my knees, and they ultimately broke. So I had surgery on the posterior and anterior cruciates on my left leg, but then carried on working for about another 10 years after that. Had a very, very, very good sports surgeon in France with the circus we're touring with at the time, so managed to make a full recovery.
That's good.
Right. I was just watching your reel this morning, so I saw a couple of clips of that, and she really jumps out there and then you catch her. It's like, you really have to trust this person, because she's like really just flinging forward and okay, there you are.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was obviously, you know, all the training is done under very controlled circumstances. I mean, we always utilize the safety, but the advantage of working with a cradle at that height is that you can take those big jumps and those big risks because of the fact that you're tethered to an auto lunge system, which basically meant that we didn't need to have somebody holding the line for us. Juliet had developed an automatic lunging system that she used on her swing and trapeze act, which, funnily enough, actually came from a recommendation of a friend of hers, a guy called Nicky Dewhurst. And Nicky and his father, Brian Dewhurst, were performers on the very first ever show of Cirque du Soleil, Salt and Banco. And Nicky's partner, wife, girlfriend at the time, she was also a swing and trapeze artist. And they had developed this safety system, basically, which involved putting a weight onto the lunge line. So instead of having someone holding the lunge line and taking up the slack, the weight did that. And then the far end of the lunge line was anchored to a bungee system, which would stretch and absorb the energy if the artist fell off. But it just meant you could be totally self-contained. And we managed to adapt that and transfer that onto our cradle act as well, which was great because it meant that we didn't need to rely on anybody.
Right.
From a safety perspective, you know, we could just take care of all the rigging bits ourselves, and it just made things a lot easier. Yeah. Being working at height, also advantages are that it's visually impressive because you're a lot higher. You know, we used to work at around about 10 meters, which is about 30 foot up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
From an audience perspective, or their perception is automatically, it's wow, there's a lot more wow factor because of the height involved. Then you've got the dynamics involved of the swinging and the large release and catch moves. But the safety advantage is that if you're utilizing a safety line, is that you've got all of that time, you've got all of that space between the flyer, you know, like if they do miss a trick, and the ground for that safety system to kick in and decelerate.
Mm.
Some cradle acts work over mats and they won't use a safety line at all, but then your reflexes have to be incredibly quick because if you're upside down and facing the wrong way, even landing on a mat can be pretty bad.
Right.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're on a lunge system, there's a lot less that can go wrong in that way, if you know what I mean.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
So moving into rigging stuff.
Yeah, sorry. That's terrible, isn't it?
No, that's fantastic. Yeah. This is a great segue. And I'm interested how you transitioned from aerial to rigging and the developments of it over the years, which you've sort of started talking about.
But tell us if there's more of your, you know, of your aerial career, don't skip it. Tell us a bit more before you get to that transitioning.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's not a lot really. I mean, basically, after that season in Blackpool, I toured with a show in the UK, Cirque Surreal. And during that season, trained up a balance perch act, which is where you have a prop that is either balanced on your shoulders or on your head. And we, in our instance, we had a big circular prop made that was probably about 2 meters in diameter that I would balance. And then my flyer, which was Juliet, would climb up and she would perform doing aerial maneuvers on the top of the hoop. And so that's called a balance perch act. And we trained that act up.
From your head?
This particular one was balanced on my shoulders.
Okay.
And the following season, I had gained a contract working in France with a very big touring show. It's the biggest touring show in France at the time, Cirque Pandere, and quite a demanding schedule. They did 6 months of back-to-back one-day stands. And we did about 144 towns in that particular season. So,
wow.
It was a demanding schedule. But because I had the knee injury, which is when I first got into the cradle to do some training, we had to put the balance perch act on hold. And it took me a year to recover, basically, of having kinesiotherapy and physio. And during that time is when we started experimenting with the cordelisse, doing doubles cordelisse. Now, back then, don't forget, cordelisse was still relatively new concept. Up until that point, most rope work that was done was the Spanish web style, as opposed to, you know, free rope, cordelisse rope. And so the idea of a doubles cordelisse rope was, again, added more originality because there weren't many people. We didn't know of any at the time, actually. I'm not saying that we were the first, but we didn't know of any others that were doing doubles cordelisse, which is two performers on one rope. And then we also introduced a second rope, so just to mix it up a little bit. So that's what we ended up going with. And then toured for 7 years after that with the doubles cordelisse act. We had a season in Germany following that and then two seasons in Spain. We actually went to Mallorca initially before going to Spain to work with a Spanish show, Flick Flack.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Spanish Flick Flack that was there just for the Christmas season. Mm-hmm. And then we ended up working at the casino there for a few months, Casino Palladium, doing the doubles cordelisse and developing that further before going over to the mainland and had a beautiful year touring with a Spanish show called Circo Raluí.
Wow.
And then they took us out to an island in the Indian Ocean the following year, and we toured out there for about 5 or 6 months, an island called the Île de la Réunion, which is a French island just south of Mauritius and Madagascar. And then the following season, we went to Italy and toured with a show there called Circo Orfei. And following that, we had a couple of seasons back in France again with a show called Maximum, which is where we trained up the small flying act, the Petit Volant act, and toured that there for a year. But see, back in those shows, those touring shows, you know, it was a touring tenting show. We lived in caravans.
Mm-hmm.
It was an amazing way to, you know, get involved and submerge yourself completely into the culture of the country as well, because you have to learn the language, you have to adapt, you have to, you know, assimilate yourself. And it was brilliant. It's a really, really great learning curve. It's a better education than anything else I could, you know, expect to have had, I guess.
Yeah.
But those types of shows didn't have riggers.
Right.
You know, the artists traditionally in touring tenting circus, if you were an aerial performer, you took care of rigging your own equipment. You took care of maintaining it, installing it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, coming from the circus world back to the UK in 2003, just we'd done two seasons of Cirque Maximum, which was 2001, 2002. Then beginning of 2003, we came back. They were planning a new program. And Juliet, when we landed at the National Centre of Circus Arts, which was the circus space back then, was offered a job as the head of the aerial department on the degree course there, teaching, you know, all the aerial disciplines for the three-year university degree. So for me, I took that opportunity to set up a rigging company.
Mm.
Because circus had made the crossover at that point into the events industry.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend of mine, Joe, and I, we took that opportunity and we started up a circus rigging company. And High Performance was born that year in 2003. And it was a bit of a wake-up call for me, just because having come from the circus world where things had to be done a certain way within a certain time frame because of the fact the tent had to go up, the audience is coming in, then the tent was coming down and you're driving through to the next town. We became very streamlined and quick and proficient at what we did, which adapted well into the events industry because a lot of corporate events, they have a very short turnaround time as well.
Right.
You know, you could be looking at a window of maybe 2 hours at the most.
Wow.
From the time you're getting your equipment in until the time that the doors open and the guests are arriving. So that transition was quite familiar to me. What wasn't familiar to me was anything to do with health and safety.
Mm.
That was a real wake-up call. Coming from the circus, basically where we were responsible for our own health and safety, going into the events industry in the UK, it was a big, big, big change for me. You know, the whole concept of wearing a harness at height whilst you're installing your equipment was foreign.
Mm-hmm.
Paperwork, you know, risk assessments, method statements, load calculations, I did not have a clue what they were.
Right.
And initially, you know, the circus side of me wanted to just resist that and say, we don't bother with that sort of nonsense. But I realized pretty quickly that I wasn't going to get very far with that attitude. And so, you know, rather than fight it, we embraced it. And I made it a point to learn as much as I could and to do as many training courses as I could, which ultimately, you know, has served us very well going down that route. And back then, sort of, well, when we started that up in particular, the whole aerial side of things was starting to take off in other genres of entertainment as well. There's a large crossover of aerial work going into theatres.
Mm-hmm.
Dance companies started embracing aerial work, companies that I work quite a bit with, like Fidget Feet, for example. But one of the forerunners back then in the UK was a company called Scarabaeus.
Mm-hmm.
That were probably, I would say, that one of the original instigators of what they call vertical dance now in the UK.
Right.
Scarabaeus were probably doing that back in the UK before anyone else was. But we didn't call it vertical dance back then. It was called wall running.
Mm.
And it's quite funny now, being involved in the vertical dance world, and they refer to themselves as VD practitioners. Now, so you got to be careful with that, you know. It's like people could take that, yeah, a certain way, you know. Mm. So, yeah, the aerial circus side of things is certainly grown a lot in the 25 to 30 years that I've been in the business.
Right.
And it's changed a lot. And it's really good because it keeps things interesting. It keeps things fresh, you know. And a lot of the things that people are doing now, I can see have potentially, you know, have taken inspiration from things that have happened before, but just modified them more, you know, doing them with a different look or a different view or a different,
mm-hmm.
you know. So the way that it is evolving is good. I mean, there's so many more people in the business now as well.
It's insane, yeah.
Yeah, once upon a time, it was a very closed shop. It was something that you were born into the business. You didn't just join the circus. You had to be born into it. And if you weren't, it wasn't really the sort of thing that you could get into that easily. A little bit like the stunt rigging world on films these days. It's very difficult to get into. Yeah.
Right.
That might change, who knows?
Yeah. When you started your company, were there other rigging companies or were you like one of the very first?
There were definitely other rigging companies around, but there weren't really companies that were specializing in circus that I knew of anyway. Now, there were certainly like big, well-established rigging companies, but they were more, I guess, well, obviously the arena-style rigging, you know, the rock and roll truss and motor style. But there were certainly theatrical performer flying companies that were well-established, companies like Freedom Flying and Foy's, Flying by Foy. But they were very good at doing a particular style of flying at that time, which was your theatrical flying, which was normally sort of in a two-dimensional plane with lift and travel going across stage.
I see.
But there wasn't really that much in theatre at that particular time that involved anything else in the way of like lateral dynamics or swinging or flying trapeze as such. Mm-hmm. So we thought, okay, the trapeze element and the circus element is something that we can certainly run with, because when I say we, I'm talking about my business partner, Joe, who also comes from an aerial performance background. We started up the company together in 2003, but Joe was also an aerial performer. Now, we thought, having been circus artists ourselves working up in the air, would give us an advantage, you know.
Right.
Because we know the business, we know what the performers need, and we know what how to get it in safely and make it work, demystify it all. So they felt, made them feel a little bit more relaxed and safe with us, because they knew that, you know, we'd go into a job and rig for them knowing what it is exactly that they needed.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of that, we sort of built up a business based on recommendation and word of mouth. We never really had to put much effort into marketing or building up a client base, which is something I'm still asked about, you know, to this very day, with my business manager and my bank manager asking me, what's your business plan? What's your marketing strategy? And I say, it's like, well, I don't have one. I never have. I mean, obviously, social media has helped a lot in the last few years. I mean, when we started circus, mobile phones didn't even really exist. They were just the big Motorola bricks. I mean, that's the sort of level of technology we're looking at back at the time. But obviously now, social media has changed the circus industry a lot. Mm-hmm. So has the internet, because it used to be, once upon a time, you'd have to go to a very well-established circus agent.
Mm.
And to get into an agent's books in the first place wasn't easy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There were some elite agents that were considered, you know, they were the ones that would get you on the best festivals, you know, like Monte Carlo or the festivals abroad, and they'd also get you into the best shows. You know, with social media, I mean, it's great in the respect that, I mean, obviously it hasn't done the agents any favours, because a lot of the clients are now going direct to the artists and cutting out the agent. But, you know, that has its pros and cons. Obviously the pros being that, you know, it's good for the client, but the cons being that sometimes you can't see the wood for the trees, or, you know, it's very difficult to find quality when there's so much out there, and it's very easy to make yourself look good online.
Mm-hmm.
But having a recommendation from an established agent back in the day was worth its weight in gold, you know, having that agent behind you.
Mm-hmm.
But also from a marketing perspective, like for what we do, you know, the whole social media thing has been good as well, because obviously we are reconnecting with a lot of the old artists that, you know, that I used to tour with back in the day. And it's like people that I've lost contact with and haven't heard from for over 20 years, all of a sudden you find them online.
Right.
And that whole network of people also is very good at generating interest in what we do, which ultimately leads on to generating more work for us as well. So that's our marketing strategy, really.
Yeah, that's great. How has rigging changed over the years? I mean, obviously the demand is bigger. The equipment has changed.
Yeah, I mean, the equipment is constantly, you know, changing. There's new products coming out on the market all the time. And unless you're the sort of person that's a fanatic about it, or you're a geek about it and you're constantly online looking for the latest new things, it's really hard to keep up with
mm-hmm.
all the new products that are out there. I mean, fundamentally, they're all pretty much, you know, they serve the same purpose. You know, there might be a new style of, say, for example, a carabiner
mm-hmm.
that comes out that has a new locking mechanism or a new gate, which makes it safer or makes it easier to utilize. So those changes are good. What I suppose keeps changing is the way that people use the gear, because there are so many people coming into the business now that they're trying to find their own individuality. They're trying to find something special that makes them stand out from the crowd. And so I've found the skills are evolving at a very, very fast rate.
Right.
The tricks that the young people are doing now in the schools are getting bigger and more scary, and as a result of that, the bigger tricks, they create more loadings occasionally with, you know, bigger, large dynamics, big tricks.
Mm-hmm.
Those things are constantly evolving. It's like I say when I teach my rigging course, I say every 4 years when you see the Olympics, you see the gymnasts and the ice skaters, pushing themselves and doing things, or the sprinters running faster than they ever have before. They keep pushing, keep pushing. It's the same in the circus world, I've found. And some of the stuff that they're doing now is just absolutely amazing. It's like, you know, if I had to start now, I wouldn't get a look into the circus business just because I wouldn't be good enough. So it's what they're doing, I guess, makes it just as difficult, you know, from a rigging perspective,
mm-hmm.
just because of the fact that we have to keep up with what they are doing a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. I know that I've got a lot of friends that work in the schools all around the world, you know, like riggers and the different circus schools. And some of the stories they've told me, you know, where they, like, students come up with these wacky and ideas that they want to try and do things that have never been done before, like rigging an inverted Chinese pole from just things that you just wouldn't think of. I mean, that wasn't a great example, but then you have to cater for them, obviously, because you want to help them, you know, sort of progress, and you want to help them sort of come up with something that's original and unique. But also at the same time, it's a little bit like working with a director as well. It's, you know, a show director. You want them to be able to realize their artistic ambitions or their goals, but at the same time, you have to sort of give them a reality check every now and again and sort of say, well, actually, from a practical perspective, that isn't necessarily going to work that easily. And then also there's the whole safety side of it as well. So
right.
Without trying to put a dampener on things, you want to keep them motivated and encouraged, but at the same time, keep them safe, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then also there's the practical side of things as well, because a lot of the acts or a lot of these ideas that people are coming up with, in the real world, when you get out there and you have to work, it's like you need to be out, this needs to work in a variety of different spaces. Otherwise, you know,
right.
It's like learning like a big aerial dynamic act. It's great if you're working in a big venue or in a big show, but I know so many people that have trained up, like swinging trapeze, for example, to a really high level, and find it really difficult to get work because there's just not the gigs, you know, because the venues aren't high enough. And the only way that they can actually sort of get an outlet is if they actually go and tour on a show that needs a swinging act, for example.
Right.
So there's that practical sort of element of being able to advise people as well. It's about not just thinking about the actual components of the rigging, but the practicality of the whole bigger picture, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We'll be right back after the short break.
Can you tell us about a job that was, it doesn't have to be the craziest, but maybe one of your favorite acts that you ever had to rig or invent for an artist, and most innovative or?
Well, I mean, so many jobs that we've done over the years, and they're all good and they're all different in their own way, obviously. I mean, about 2010, we've really started doing a lot of big high wire installations.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of, 200 to 300 meters in length and 40, 50 meters up in the air. So they always present a challenge. We were at one point looking to rig a high wire across Victoria Falls in Africa right on the border between Zimbabwe and Zambia there. And it's never been done before. And it was a real challenge just going there and doing the site visit and trying to figure out how we were going to do this. One of the biggest obstacles or one of the biggest things that we had to overcome was trying to figure out how we're going to get the first wire across, because it's basically, I think, the shortest part that we could find that we could rig was going to be about 300 meters. Now, normally, you know, you'd be able to haul something up from down ground level, you know. So you run a line across, haul it up one side, then haul it up the other side, and use it as a catenary to then curtain track the bigger wires across. Trouble was, where we were rigging, the locals, you know, our guides had said, oh, no, you can't go down there. I said, well, why, what's the problem? I said, oh, it's full of, like venomous snakes and spiders and... You just die, you know. I mean, there were baboons running around the place as well, nicking stuff out of your bag. So it's like anything that wasn't.
I know.
It was mad. It was really mad. it's like the carabiners and stuff just would have been stolen, all the rigging gear. But anyway, that's just, you know, one thing. I mean, we didn't actually end up doing it in the end because it was cost prohibitive. We were doing it for Comic Relief, which was to raise money for charity. And it was very last minute. And it meant we were going to have to air freight everything across. And it was going to cost a lot of money. And the whole objective was to raise money for charity, not spend it.
Right.
We've still got all the plans. So you never know. At some point in the future, it might rear its head again. One of the other interesting aerial rigs that we did. We worked on a touring show of Batman. This was back in 2006, I think it was. It toured for a couple of years. It toured in the UK and went to the States. It was supposed to tour for longer. It was 2007, 2008 by the time it got to the States. And obviously that's when the last major recession happened. I don't know if you remember that.
Right.
But so it was a stadium show, an arena show, and it needed about 4,000 people per show to break even. And so people weren't spending money at the time. So it toured for a couple of years and it finished prematurely. But part of the show, the director had said, because they were introducing Robin and his family, the Flying Graysons, into the Batman story. And he said, oh, yeah, we want to have a flying trapeze act. And what happens is that, you know, Cable gets cut and then they fall down and Robin's parents die. He said, but the rig has got to go up and it's got to go down in about 30 seconds. And I said, well, that's not really going to be that easy, you know, because you've got a net to think about. You've got obviously all the top rigging as well. But it was just getting the net in and out and stuff as well, which, you know, it can be done. But we found a solution, which was basically to utilize a swinging cradle instead, which had a big long, it was probably about 4 to 5 meters in length. So by the time you've got a catcher swinging on the end of that and then a flyer underneath it, it filled up the space very, very nicely. You know, you're probably looking at about a 10 meter arc with a flyer hanging underneath. So it's good to sort of sometimes take a step back and look at the overall image of what it is that they're trying to achieve or the story that they're trying to tell and find a solution that's a little bit more practical.
Right.
It's good, again, sort of having had the touring experience and knowing how things have to go in and out quickly as part of a show when you're talking to creatives, because they don't always realise the technical sort of implications of what it is that they're asking.
Right.
So they can just see the artistic picture, but not the actual, the mechanics and the machinery behind the scenes. Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. Well, you're talking about practicality. So for just the average everyday aerialist, what would you say is the bare minimum that they should know?
Well, I think knowing the limitations of your equipment is fundamental. What's really important, and one of the things that I try to drive home when I'm teaching the rigging course, is to know when to ask a question, you know? Mm. I know from having gone into various venues myself, you know, when I was younger, that are sometimes made to feel intimidated or stupid to ask a question, because you quite often got a grumpy rigger replying to you saying, you trying to tell me how to do my job? It's like, well, no, I'm just asking because, you know, I'm curious and I care about my life. So I think knowing when to ask a question and also sort of being assertive, trusting your own instincts is also really important as well. If you're unsure about something, you're unsure about it for a reason. Mm. And those like first impressions, those instincts are normally right, you know, so trust your instincts. I also say, you know, keep your mind open to training as well. Don't ever think that you've, and I'm not insinuating that people do, but don't sort of get to the point where you think you know enough or you know everything. I mean, every time I teach, I learn something new from my students. Every time I teach a course, I'm learning something, which is good.
Yeah.
You know, I'll show them how to tie a knot and someone will go, oh, actually, I know another way of tying that knot, and they'll show me. And so it's like you never stop learning. So I think that's probably another thing that I'd say is, yeah, it's sort of like, keep an open mind to continued education, you know. Don't think that you know it all and keep learning as much as you can.
Right. And just to add to that, you have your company and your rig, but you also created this certification, right?
Well, yes, I say created the certification. I basically give the delegates on my rigging course a certificate of attendance and completion.
Right.
I've got to be very careful to say it's not a qualification.
Right.
Because people are constantly asking me, how can I get a rigging qualification? And the truth is, in Europe, they don't exist.
Huh.
The closest thing that we have to a rigging qualification as such would be what they call the National Rigging Certificate in the UK. But it doesn't train you. It's an assessment-based accreditation, and it doesn't really pertain to performer flying as such. It's more to do with arena rigging,
okay,
which is very good if you're working in that industry. And also it just demonstrates, you know, that you've achieved a certain level of competency as well.
Right.
But there's no formal rigging qualification as such in Europe. So the law basically dictates that you need to be able to demonstrate competency. And one way of obviously being able to do that is through experience and also through formal training. Now, because in any rigging qualification, formal training, if you're a rigger, you're going to be working at height. So working at height accreditation is a good one to have, you know, something like rope access. They call it SPRAT in the States. It's IRATA as well we have over here, which is the Industrial Rope Access Trade Association. Then you have your plant accreditation. If you're working at height and machinery, things like scissor lifts and cherry pickers, you can get accreditation for that.
Right.
So all of those accreditations, there's rescue, all of those go towards demonstrating competency. And I've geared the course that I teach, which is called Rigging Fundamentals for Aerial Performance. It's a two-day course, but there's so much information to impart, and you've got to be very selective about what it is that you're trying to teach in that time, because too much information you know, and then people's brains just shut off.
Mm-hmm.
So try and keep it relevant, keep it simple, keep it pertinent is what I've found. And sometimes less is more as well, you know, sort of just highlighting the important points. And over the years that I've been teaching it, it's only been about, I think I'm in my ninth year this year since I started the course. And every year, obviously, things change. And so I'm constantly updating the manuals. I'm also updating the way that I teach, the way that I try to explain things. But I've also got to make sure that what I'm saying is correct as well. I'm trying to keep up with any changes in legislation.
Mm-hmm.
So no, it's good. It's an educational process for me the whole time as well.
I took your course the first time we met at the IADF. And before I had done yours, I had done one here in the US. And that was my first one, the one here in the US.
Yeah.
And at the end of that first one, I remember thinking that there was so much more that I didn't know. That first course just opened the door for me to know that there's so much information and I have no business touching any rigging until I know more, you know? Because before that, I didn't know what I didn't know.
Sure.
So by the time I got to do yours, then I had a better idea and I had a better understanding. But now it's been, that was probably 2015 since I took yours, and it's not something that I use all the time. So I couldn't tell you much about it.
Yeah. Well, to be honest, in 2015, my course was fairly in its infancy. It had only been running for about 3 years by that stage. But it's very surprising to me. I mean, I've had people, candidates, delegates come back onto the course just a year or so later. I had about three or four people from one course came back the very next year and did exactly the same course again. And they still didn't pass the test with 100%. And they bloody well should. You know, it's like,
I did pass mine. Just, you know.
Oh, no, that's good. Yeah, no, I'm sure you did. But no, it's amazing because the thing is as well, it's stuff that, you know, unless you're using it on a fairly regular basis, it's like what we, you know, as an artist, repetition, repetition, repetition until it becomes second nature. You can teach things, you can tell people things until you're blue in the face, but unless these are things that they're utilizing on a regular basis, of course they're not necessarily going to retain it, mm-hmm. that knowledge. But the thing that I do try and teach now as well is basically knowing your limitations. So doing that course, I mean, I think for you, Lydia, in particular, you've said what it did do is it opened up your eyes to how many more possibilities there are out there or how much information that there is.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I can achieve that when I'm teaching, then I feel like I've succeeded in a way, just to be able to sort of like make people realize that there is a lot to take in and never stop learning, I guess, and just know when to ask the right questions.
Right. Yeah, I remember it had a rescue component to it.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if you still do that part.
Yeah.
We had to go up and rescue our friend in need up there.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's still a part of the course. That's what we call in Ireland a bit of crack, you know, just for everyone to get together after they've done the test. So we have that as the last bit, basically. I do the practical test and then in the afternoon after lunch, we'll get together and have a bit of a fun session. So everyone gets to abseil down, get stuck, and then someone has to come and rescue them, and then they'll swap roles. So everyone gets to be a rescuer and a rescuee. That makes sense. But no, that's always a good sort of like group exercise, bit of a bonding session for everyone as well. They always seem to have fun with that one.
Yeah. Well, for me, I rescued my guy and then I landed on him.
Oh, no.
And then I was stuck and I couldn't get up. So I was just straddling him while he was on the ground.
Well, at least you're safely on the ground by that point.
Yeah, I couldn't get up. His girlfriend was standing there. She wasn't that amused. And Brian was just laughing. Laughing the whole time.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
You got to have a bit of fun with it, eh?
Nice.
You said that you were actually introduced to the safety side of things from your partner.
Yep.
And now I wonder if there are a lot of women in rigging or is it mostly guys?
The circus industry, I found, these days is very largely dominated by women, to be honest. I mean, as far as from a performance perspective goes, it's probably like 90% women, I would have thought.
Right.
But yet the rigging industry still seems to stay male dominated. Now, I don't know why that is. There are more and more women coming into the business, but I guess it's a throwback to the arena rigging where it had always been a very male dominated industry as well. I get contacted fairly regularly of people wanting to get into the performer flying side of the business, people that have worked as arena riggers or rock and roll riggers, but wanting to diversify and get into the performer flying world.
Hmm.
But the majority of them that do contact me are men. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why that is. I don't know if it's something maybe that men are more interested in, perhaps.
Right.
The women riggers that I've worked with are very capable in every way that a man is, because you don't need to be a physical brute. You don't need to be strong. These days you've got machinery and stuff that can do that for you. It's about having a good brain and having a competency. And so it's open and available to everybody. But it's a difficult industry to get into in the first place anyway, because there's not a lot of openings for people, just because of the fact there aren't a lot of companies doing it, I guess. Mm. And those companies that are doing it are quite sort of specific about who they want to work with. It's a bit of a catch-22 for people wanting to get in, because you need to have experience, but you can't get experience until you get in. So that's one of those difficult ones, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's also the stunt rigging world in film is very much like that as well. It's a very difficult industry. There's a lot of people that want to get into that, and there's a lot of crossover between performer flying and the stunt rigging.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of the techniques are very similar, the harnesses, there's a lot of crossover and all of that type of stuff. Obviously, the film industry is a lot more lucrative because the budgets are a lot bigger. Yeah. And so that's, I guess, one industry in particular a lot of people are trying to break into. But again, it's very closed shop. It's a very difficult industry to get into. The people that have got the jobs there, hold on to them.
Right.
They're very reluctant to give those jobs up because of the fact that, it is a lucrative industry. Having said that, though, you have to really be married to it as well. If you're working in film in particular, you could be away from home for months at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also the sort of industry that if you say no to a job once, they will replace you with somebody. And it's very difficult then to get back into it once you said no. So it's the sort of thing that once you're in, it's like being in a gang, I would have thought. There's no out, you're in. Or if you get out, that's it.
Forever.
Yeah. The rigging mafia.
Brian, have you seen this stuff that now Sar has been working on? You know Sar, of course.
Yes, yeah. I've seen the stuff that she's doing with ropes. I mean, she seems to be doing that for a long time now. Multiple vertical ropes.
Right.
But I've seen her. I've only seen her on video. I've never seen her perform it live. I saw her do a little section of it once at the EADF at the point. I think she was doing. Yeah, mm-hmm. She's another one that's actually a very, very accomplished and competent rigger.
Right, exactly. And I think this new research that she's been working on and with her master's, I believe, is her master's degree, she's doing rigging as a performance a little bit more so. Instead of having the two separate that, you have your rigger that serves the purpose and then the performer comes in, she's making it into one.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, that is a thing. There's a guy called Barnes who used to be a rigger with NoFit State Circus, and he started up his own company called Pirates of the Carabiner. I don't know if you've heard of them, but but he's a rigger, but he's a performing rigger. So all of his rigging is incorporated as part of the show.
Hmm.
He does a lot of counterweighting and all that sort of thing, but he's in costume and he's there doing the rigging as he's working. And, it's choreographed as part of the show. So I think that's interesting that Sar's doing that. I think that's a really good idea. What amazes me, though, is that you can actually do a master's nowadays in circus. Isn't that incredible?
Yes,
I mean, I've got another colleague, another friend of mine, Jean-Paul Zaccarini. I think he's a professor of circus now. But, yeah, I think my old circus boss would have raised an eyebrow at that, to think that you could actually go to university and get never mind just a degree, but a master's, PhD,
Right.
That's a sign of the times, isn't it?
Mm-hmm, right.
Yeah.
Just changed and it's evolved so much. And now it's just everywhere, right? Everywhere mm-hmm. you look, there's aerial.
Yeah.
Which is great. It's great.
Yeah, no, it's been good for us as well. I mean, the whole sort of the fitness industry is very much embraced aerial now as well. Pole studios and aerial yoga and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
Like during this last pandemic in particular, I mean, we lost all of our work. We went from being flat out to zero. To nothing. But in the little pockets of time there, things did open briefly before they closed again. They opened again, they closed again. The one constant was the fitness studios, because when we're installing equipment into fitness studios, whether it's rigging points or wall points or floor anchors, they have to be inspected on a fairly regular basis just to keep the continued certification scheme going. So we go back in and we just make sure that the equipment is still safe to use. A lot of the components that get rigged up in these training studios and circus schools, sometimes they're up for months at a time and they get very intensive use.
Mm-hmm.
Things, like carabiners and swivels and rigging paws and all that, they do deteriorate over time. There's, with wear and abrasion. So they do have to be monitored.
Right.
So that was one of the things that kept us going in the last year and a half, to a certain extent anyway.
Yeah.
A lot of the aerial equipment has stolen from climbing equipment, like the swivel, the carabiner, you know, all that kind of stuff. Is there now equipment that's invented specifically for aerial?
Hardware, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, yes, to a certain degree. I mean, I know what you're saying, you know, about us utilizing equipment from the different industries. I mean, obviously the two main ones are the leisure climbing world, working at high PPE equipment as well. And then there's the lifting accessories, you know, the big industrial components that we use from the lifting world, things like the big heavy duty shackles and steel wire rope and round slings. So those are the two main areas that we utilize equipment from in circus rigging. But there are companies that are building bespoke components now. There's a company in France called Black Z, which is run by a guy called Thomas Loriot. He's an engineer, but he's also an aerialist. So he comes from a good background, obviously, to be able to be in that position, because he's got a good understanding of the business from a performance perspective, but also from the technical perspective as well. Their company, Black Z, they're manufacturing components now through another company of his called Katz Engineering. But they are making bespoke anchor plates and attachments and various things. So if you have a look at their website, if you Google them, it's blackz.fr. But they're a good supplier here in Europe for equipment that is actually specifically made for circus. I mean, they do still use some components from the leisure climbing world and from the lifting world as well. I think we always will. As long as we know their limitations and as long as we're utilizing them, you know, as per the manufacturer's recommendations, then there's no reason why we shouldn't use them. You know, we have been for a very long time, especially from the industrial lifting world, it comes to putting up big structures like circus tents, for example. You know, we're still using it with steel wire rope and shackles, and we have done for a very, very long time. But swivels have been around for a very long time, but obviously we're utilizing climbing swivels now because they're lightweight. Traditionally, circus swivels have been around for a very, very, very long time. The ones from the early days that I used to see, they wouldn't have any locking mechanism. They'd just have a big, long hook, and then there'd be a swivel with a loop at the bottom. And they'd use those on the top of web ropes, for example. But I remember those being around decades ago. So, and before that, aerialists like the forerunners of aerial work, like Lillian Litzel, who worked on Ringling Brothers last century or century before even, she'd do the rings. And at the end of the show, I think she'd do like 100 almost one-arm turns.
Oh, yeah.
And her swivel was actually made of leather. I mean, it was the thing that ultimately killed her because the leather broke.
Wow.
I don't know why I laughed at that. But yeah, but I mean, so things we think are new aren't new. They've just been redesigned, I guess. But I think taking equipment from the climbing world makes a lot of sense, because to be sold off the shelf to a mass market, they have to conform to certain standards. So they'll be designed to a standard, and then normally, well, in Europe anyway, they're then certified by a notified body, which gives them what we call a CE mark. So it just means people that are coming in and buying components can at least buy things knowing that they're going to get something that's good quality.
Right.
Whereas in the old days, it was always just a bit hit and miss. You know, you didn't always know what its background was. I mean, we never even really asked. I remember sort of like the very first time when I got up onto that aerial swing that I told you about back in New Zealand when I did that very first act. I didn't know a thing about rigging. I just had complete faith that my circus boss did.
Right.
And when I think back to it now, he basically hung that swing on big metal hooks, and they hooked into these two lugs that were welded onto the ridge bar in the tent. And, you know, I mean, knowing what I know now, I definitely wouldn't have done that. But, you know, that's the advantage we have now, though, is that we can go in and we can buy these attachments, we can buy the slings, we can buy the components, and we know that it's been manufactured to a certain standard. And also the fact that the education is out there now as well, sort of like educating people so that they know about it and they know how to utilize the gear correctly as well.
Right. And even with all that we know and all the equipment available, we know that accidents still happen, right? And
Yep. No, they do, unfortunately. I mean, we're very, very lucky in this industry, though, that, you know, relatively compared to a lot of the other industries, there are very, very few accidents in circus that are, right, you know, serious accidents. I mean, it's perceived to be dangerous what it is that we're doing, because people traditionally came to the circus to see the daring and the danger. You know, to see the young man in the flying trapeze or the lion tamer sticking his head in a lion's mouth. That's, you know, sooner or later, they're going to have a close shave. But that's what the audience wanted.
Right.
But so it still has that perception from the general public's point of view, and sometimes from the insurer's point of view as well, as being a risky occupation. But the reality is very different. I mean, if you look at the number of incidents or fatalities, you know, from the circus world compared to something else, you know, there are very, very few.
Minimal, yeah.
Yeah, it's minimal. Obviously, I mean, there's, by comparison, there's probably not as many people in the circus industry as what there are in a lot of other industries, but they really care about what they do. And the level of training now and the level of awareness and safety is so much stricter than it ever used to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's like people sort of learning to work at height. From a risk assessment point of view, if you are to use harness work to access something, that's considered to be risky because in the hierarchy of controls, which is something you have to implement when you're doing a risk assessment, PPE is considered to be the very last option that you should choose from a risk assessment perspective. So in that saying, people that are working at heights using rope access techniques is perceived to be more risky than anything else. Now, yeah, I've found the people that are trained in rope access are probably the safest people up in the air.
Right.
Because of the fact that the training is so stringent and it's so regulated and the levels of tuition are incredibly good. So, yeah. I forget now what the actual question was, but I've gone off on a bit of a ramble, so you can edit that bit. Yeah.
No, it's great. It's great. Yeah. Safety has come a long way.
Yeah. No, it certainly has. Yeah. I guess also because of the fact that there's so many more people doing it now that, you know, the standards have to be higher because we don't want to, well, you don't want to perpetuate sort of that myth of circus being risky. We want to change the public's perception that it's a fantastic thing to watch, but, you know, you're not going to walk out being completely freaked out by seeing someone, you know, escape by the skin of their teeth and meaning it.
Right. Yeah. Right.
It's more now we're watching because of the awe of what people can do versus the danger factor.
Exactly. Yeah. No, you're right. It is. It's the awe of sort of like what the human body can do, like how many twists and somersaults and turns before they caught something. Whereas before it was, oh my God, they're so brave. Walking on a high wire above the lion's cage, not only would he fall and hurt himself, but the lions might eat him as well. You know?
Yeah. Right.
But yeah, no, you're right. It is. It's way more about like good production values now and choreography and movement and appreciation of the human form. You know, it's way, way more about that now than what it is about, you know, people risking their lives, which,
right,
you know, is good considering, you know, what we do for a living.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Good. Well, it's been so great talking to you. I'm glad we were able to get you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, oh no worries at all. It's good. I'm quite happy just to sit down and have a chat. You know, it's quite nice for me just to talk without feeling the pressure of having to teach, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So no, it's been good. I've enjoyed it. Yeah, cool. All right. Well, nice chatting to you both.
Thank you so much. It's been a delight.
No worries at all.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Aerial Evolution. Huge thanks to Lydia for hosting with me and Brian for coming on. We finally got our first man and first rigger. How exciting was that? But as with first, there are also lasts. I'm sad to say, but this is going to be the last episode for a bit. Now that things are opening back up, my commercial photography work has picked up to a point that I need to take a hiatus. I do hope to resume when possible. So thanks so much for listening, and as always, please feel free to reach out if you have questions or comments about the show. Come and find Aerial Evolution on the website, Instagram, or Facebook. All are at Aerial Evolution Pod. These links will be in the show notes. Thanks again, and take care.